Pottery bowls left from past meals lay about the floor, and a planked shelf along one wall held a good 2 dozen ancestral skulls. Otherwise, the room was empty. The birdman found a place near the center of the room where the rain wasn't dripping and sat down on the dirt floor. Kalin and Richard sat side by side, facing him as the hawk watched their movements. The birdman looked at Kalin's eyes. She could tell he was used to having people be afraid when he looked at them, even if it wasn't warranted. She could tell because she was used to the same thing. This time, he found no fear.
Mother Confessor, you have not yet chosen a mate.
He gently stroked the hawk's head while he watched her. Kalin decided she didn't like his tone. He was testing.
No. Are you offering yourself?
He smiled slightly.
No. I apologize. I did not mean to offend you. Why are you not with a wizard?
All the wizards, save two, are dead. Of those two, one sold his services to a queen. The other was struck down by an underworld beast and lies in a sleep. There are none left to protect me. All the other confessors have been killed. We are in dark times. His eyes looked genuinely sympathetic, but his tone still was not.
It is dangerous for a confessor to be alone.
Yes, and it is also dangerous for a man to be alone with a confessor who is in great want of something. From where I sit, it would seem that you are in greater danger than I.
Perhaps, he said, stroking the hawk, his slight smile returning.
Perhaps.
This one is a true seeker, one named by a wizard?
Yes. The birdman nodded.
It has been many years since I have seen a true seeker. A seeker who was not a real seeker came here one time. He killed some of my people when we would not give him what he wanted.
I am sorry for them, she said. He shook his head slowly.
Do not be. They died quickly. Be sorry for the seeker.
He did not. The hawk blinked as it looked at her.
I have never seen a pretend seeker, but I have seen this one in the rage. Believe me, you and your people do not want to ever give this one cause to draw his sword in anger. He knows how to use the magic. I have even seen him strike down evil spirits.
He studied her eyes for a moment, seeming to judge the truth of what she said.
Thank you for the warning. I will remember your words.
Richard spoke up at last.
Are you two about done threatening each other?
Kalin looked at him in surprise.
I thought you couldn't understand their language.
Can't, but I can understand eyes. If looks caused sparks, this place would be ablaze.
Kalin turned back to the birdman.
The seeker wishes to know if we are finished threatening each other.
He glanced at Richard and then back to her.
He is an impatient man, is he not?
She nodded.
I have told him so myself. He denies it.
It must be a burden traveling with him.
Kalin broke into a smile.
Not at all.
The birdman returned her smile and then addressed his gaze to Richard.
If we choose not to help you, how many of us will you kill?
Kalin interpreted the words as they spoke.
None.
The birdman studied the hawk as he asked.
And if we choose not to help Darkin Rahl, how many of us will he kill?
Sooner or later, a great many. He took his hand away from the hawk and looked at Richard with his sharp eyes.
It would seem you argue for us to help Darkin Rahl.
A smile spread across Richard's face.
If you choose not to help me and remain neutral, foolish as that would be, it is your right, and I will harm none of your people. But Rahl will. I will press on and fight against him with my last breath if need be.
His face took on a dangerous expression. He leaned forward.
If, on the other hand, you choose to help Darkin Rahl and I defeat him, I will come back and...
He pulled his finger across his throat in a quick gesture that needed no translation. The birdman sat stone-faced,
no quick retort at hand.
"We wish only to be left alone," he said at last.
Richard shrugged, looking down at the ground.
"I can understand that. I, too, wished only to be left alone."
His eyes came up. "Darkin Rahl killed my father and sends evil spirits that haunt me in my father's guise. He sends men to try to kill Kalin. He brings down the boundary to invade my homeland. His minions have struck down my two oldest friends. They lie in a deep sleep, near death, but at least they will live, unless he is successful the next time. Kalin has told me of many he has killed. Children, stories that would make your heart sick."
He nodded, his voice soft, hardly more than a whisper.
"Yes, my friend, I too wished only to be left alone. On the first day of winter, if Darkin Rahl gains the magic he seeks, he will have a power no one can stand against. Then it will be too late." His hand went to his sword. Kalin's eyes widened. "If he were here, in my place, he would pull this sword and have your help or have your head." He took his hand away. "That, my friend, is why I cannot harm you if you choose not to help me." The birdman sat quiet and still for a while.
"I can see now that I do not want Darkin Rahl for an enemy, or you."
He got up and went to the door, casting the hawk into the sky. The birdman sat once more, sighing heavily with the weight of his thoughts.
"Your words seem to flow true, but I cannot know for sure yet. It would also seem that, although you want us to help you, you also wish to help us. I believe you are sincere in this. It is a wise man who seeks help by helping, and not by threats or tricks.
If I wanted to get your help by tricks, I would have let you believe me to be a spirit." The corners of the birdman's mouth turned up in a small smile.
"If we had held a gathering, we would have discovered you are not. A wise man would suspect that, too. So which reason is it that made you tell the truth? You did not want to trick us, or you were afraid to?"
Richard smiled back. "In truth?"
"Both."
The birdman nodded.
"Thank you for the truth."
Richard sat quietly, took a deep breath, and let it out slowly.
"So, birdman, I have told you my tale. You must judge it true or not. Time works against me. Will you help?"
"It is not that simple. My people look to me for direction. If you asked for food, I could say, 'Give him food,' and they would do so. But you have asked for a gathering. That is different. The Council of Seers are the six elders you spoke to, plus myself. They are old men, firm in the ways of their past. An outsider has never been given a gathering before, never been permitted to disturb the peace of our ancestor spirits. Soon, these six will join the ancestor spirits, and they do not want to think they will be called from the spirit world for an outsider's needs. If they break the tradition, they will be forever burdened with their results. I cannot order them to do this."
"It is not only an outsider's needs," Kalin said, telling them both her words. "Helping us also helps the mud people."
"Maybe in the end," the birdman said, "but not in the beginning."
"What if I were one of the mud people?" Richard asked, his eyes narrowing.
"Then they would call the gathering for you and not violate the tradition."
"Could you make me one of the mud people?" The birdman's silver-gray hair glistened in the firelight as he considered.
"If you were to first do something that helped our people, something that benefited them, with no advantage to you, prove you were a man of good intentions toward us, doing so without promise of aid for your help, and the elders wished it, I could,
and once you named me as one of the mud people, I could ask for a gathering, and they would call it?
If you were one of us, they would know you had our interests in your heart. They would call a council of seers to help you.
And if they called the council, would they be able to tell me where the object I seek is located?
I cannot answer that. Sometimes the spirits will not answer our questions. Sometimes they do not know the answers to our questions. There is no guarantee that we could help you, even if we held a gathering. All I could promise is that we would try our best.
Richard looked down at the ground, thinking. With his finger, he pushed some dirt into one of the puddles where the rain dripped.
Kalin, he asked quietly, do you know of anyone else who would have the power to tell us where to look for the box?
Kalin had been giving this consideration all day.
I do, but of all the ones I know of, I do not know of any who would be any more eager to help us than the mud people are. Some would kill us just for asking.
Well, of the ones who wouldn't kill us just for asking, how far away are they?
3 weeks at least, north through very dangerous country controlled by Rahl.
3 weeks, Richard said out loud with a heavy tone of disappointment.
But Richard, the Birdman is able to promise us precious little. If you could find a way to help them, if it pleases the elders, if they ask the Birdman to name you one of the mud people, if the Council of Seers can get an answer, if the spirits even know the answer, if, many opportunities for a wrong step.
Was it not you who told me I would have to win them over? He asked with a smile.
It was.
So, what do you think? Do you think we should stay and try to convince them to help, or we should go to find the answers elsewhere?
She shook her head slowly.
I think you are the seeker, and you will have to decide.
He smiled again.
You are my friend. I could use your advice.
She hooked some hair behind her ear.
I don't know what advice to give, Richard. And my life, too, depends upon you making the right choice. But as your friend, I have faith that you will decide wisely.
Will you hate me, he grinned, if I make the wrong choice? She looked into his gray eyes, eyes that could see into her, eyes that made her weak with longing.
Even if you chose wrong, and it cost me my life, she whispered, swallowing back the lump in her throat. I could never hate you.
He looked away from her, back down at the dirt a while, then once again up to the Birdman. Do your people like having roofs that leak? The Birdman raised an eyebrow.
Would you like it if water dripped on your face when you were asleep?
Smiling, Richard shook his head. Then why don't you make roofs that don't leak? The Birdman shrugged.
Because it cannot be done. We have no materials at hand to use. Clay bricks are too heavy and would fall down. Wood is too scarce. It must be carried long distances. Grass is all we have, and it leaks.
Richard took one of the pottery bowls and turned it upside down under one of the drips.
You have clay from which you make pottery. Our ovens are small. We could not make a pot that big. And besides, it would crack. Then it too would leak. It cannot be done.
It is a mistake to say something cannot be done simply because you don't know how to do it. I would not be here otherwise. He said this gently, without malice. Your people are strong and wise. I would be honored if the Birdman would allow me to teach his people how to make roofs that do not leak, and also let the smoke out at the same time. The Birdman considered this without showing any emotion.
If you could do this, it would be a great benefit to my people, and they would give you many thanks. But I can make no promises beyond that.
Richard shrugged.
None asked for. The answer may still be no. You must accept that, if that is the answer, and bring no harm to my people.
I will do my best for your people, and hope only that they judge me fairly.
then you are free to try. But I cannot see how you will make a roof of clay that will not crack and leak.
I will make you a roof for your spirit house that will have 1,000 cracks, but will not leak. Then I will teach you to make more for yourselves.
The birdman smiled and gave a nod. Chapter 24.
I hate my mother.
The master, sitting cross-legged on the grass, looked down at the bitter expression on the boy's face and waited a moment before he answered in a quiet voice.
That is a very strong thing to say, Carl. I would not want you to say something you would come to regret when you had thought it over.
I thought it over plenty, Carl snapped. We've talked about it a long time. I know now how they twisted me around, deceived me, how selfish they are.
He squinted his eyes.
How they are enemies of the people.
Rahl glanced up at the windows, at the last tinge of fading sunlight turning the wisps of clouds a beautiful, deep, reddish purple, frosted with tips of gold.
Tonight, tonight, at long last, would be the night he returned to the underworld.
For most of long days and nights, he had kept the boy awake with the special gruel, allowing him to sleep for only brief spells, kept him awake to hammer away at him until his mind was empty and could be molded. He had talked to the boy endlessly, convincing him how others had used him, abused him, and lied to him. Sometimes he had left the boy to think over what he had been told and used the excuse to visit his father's tomb and read the sacred inscriptions again, or to snatch some rest. And then, last night, he had taken that girl to his bed to get some relaxation, a small, momentary diversion, an interlude of gentleness to feel another's soft flesh against his, to relieve his pent-up excitement. She should have been honored, especially after he had been so tender with her, so charming. She had been anxious enough to be with him. But what did she do? She laughed. When she saw the scars, she laughed. As he thought of it now, Rahl had to strain to control his rage, strain to show the boy a smile, strain to hide his impatience to get on with it. He thought of what he had done to the girl, the exhilaration of his violence unleashed, her ripping screams. The smile came more easily to his lips. She would laugh at him no more.
"What's the big grin for?" Carl asked.
Rahl looked down at the boy's big brown eyes.
"I was just thinking about how proud I am of you."
His smile widened as he remembered the way her hot, sticky blood pumped and spurted as she screamed. Where was her haughty laughter then?
Me?
Carl asked, smiling shyly. Rahl's blonde head nodded.
Yes, Carl, you.
Not many young men of your age would be intelligent enough to see the world as it really is, to see beyond their own lives to the wider dangers and wonders all about, to see how hard I work to bring safety and peace to the people.
He shook his head sadly. Sometimes it hurts my heart to see the very ones for whom I struggle so hard turn their backs to me, reject my tireless efforts, or worse yet, join with the enemies of the people. I have not wanted to burden you with worry for me, but right now, as I speak with you, there are evil people who plot to conquer us, to crush us. They have brought down the boundary that protected Dahara, and now the second boundary, too. I fear they plot an invasion. I've tried to warn the people of the danger from Westland, to get them to do something to protect themselves, but they are poor and simple people. They look to me for protection.
Carl's eyes widened.
Father Rahl, are you in danger? Rahl brushed the matter away with a wave of his hand.
It's not me I fear for. It's the people. If I were to die, who would protect them?
Die?
Karl's eyes filled with tears.
Oh, Father Rahl, we need you. Please, don't let them get you. Please, let me fight at your side. I want to help protect you. I couldn't stand the thought of you getting hurt.
Rahl's breathing quickened. His heart raced. The time was near. It would not be long now. He smiled warmly at Karl as he remembered the girl's hoarse screams.
I could not stand the thought of you being in danger for me.
Karl, I have come to know you these last days.
You are more to me than simply a young man who was chosen to help me with the ceremony.
You have become my friend.
I have shared my deepest concerns with you, my hopes, my dreams. I don't do that with many. It's enough to know you care.
Tears in his eyes, Karl looked up at the master.
Father Rahl,
he whispered,
I'd do anything for you. Please let me stay. After the ceremony, let me stay and be with you. I'll do anything you need, I promise, if I could just stay with you.
Oh, Karl, that's so like you, so kind.
But you have a life, parents, friends, and Tinker. Don't forget your dog.
Soon you will be wanting to go back to all that. Karl slowly shook his head while his eyes stayed on Rahl.
No, I won't. I only want to be with you, Father Rahl. I love you. I'd do anything for you.
Rahl considered the boy's words, a serious look on his face.
It would be dangerous for you to stay with me.
Rahl could feel his heart pounding.
I don't care. I want to serve you. I don't care if I might get killed. I only want to help you. I don't want to do anything else but help you in your fight with those enemies. Father Rahl, if I got killed helping you, it would be worth it. Please, let me stay. I'll do whatever you ask. Forever.
To help control his rapid breathing, Rahl took a deep breath and let it out slowly. His face was grave.
Are you sure of what you are saying, Karl? Are you sure you really mean it? I mean, are you really sure you would give your life for me?
I swear, I'd die to help you. My life is yours if you'll have it.
Rahl leaned back a little, put his hands on his knees, and nodded slowly, his blue eyes riveted on the boy.
Yes, Karl, I will have it.
Karl didn't smile, but shook slightly with the excitement of acceptance, his face set in determination.
When can we do the ceremony? I want to help you and the people.
Soon, Rahl said, his eyes getting wide and his speech slow. Tonight, after I have fed you.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes.
Rahl rose, feeling the surge of blood through his veins. He strained to control the flush of arousal. It was dark outside. The torches gave off a flickering light that danced in his blue eyes, gleamed on his long blonde hair, and made his white robes seem to glow. Before going to the forge room, he placed the feeding horn near Karl's mouth. Inside the dark room, his guards waited, their massive arms folded across their chests. Sweat rolling from their skin left little trails in the light covering of soot. A crucible sat in the fire of the forge, an acrid smell rising from the dross. Eyes wide, Rahl addressed his guards.
Is Demin back?
For several days, master.
Tell him to come and wait,
Rahl said, unable to manage more than a whisper.
And then I would like you two to leave me alone for now. They bowed and left through the back door.
Rawl swept his hand over the crucible, and the smell changed to an appetizing aroma. His eyes closed as he offered silent prayers to the spirit of his father. His breathing was a shallow pant. In the fervor of his emotions, he was unable to control it. He licked his shaking fingertips and rubbed them on his lips. Affixing wooden handles to the crucible so as to lift it without burning himself, he used the magic to make its weight easy to maneuver and went back through the door with it. The torches lit the area around the boy, the white sand with the symbols traced in it, the ring of grass, the altar set on the wedge of white stone. Torchlight reflected off the polished stone block that held the iron bowl with the shinga on its lid. Rawl's blue eyes took it all in as he approached the boy. He stopped in front of him by the mouth of the feeding horn. There was a glaze in his eyes as he looked down to Carl's upturned face.
"Are you sure about this, Carl?" he asked hoarsely. "Can I trust you with my life?"
"I swear my loyalty to you, Father Rawl, forever."
Rawl's eyes closed as he drew a sharp breath. Sweat beaded on his face, stuck his robes to his skin. He could feel waves of heat rolling off the crucible. He added the heat of his magic to the vessel to keep its contents boiling. Softly, he began chanting the sacred incantations in the ancient language. Charms and spells whispered their haunting sounds in the air. Rawl's back arched as he felt power surging through his body, taking him with hot promise. He shook as he chanted, offering up his words to the spirit of the boy. His eyes opened part way, the visage of wanton passion burning in them. His breathing was ragged, his hands trembled slightly. He gazed down at the boy.
"Carl," he said in a husky whisper, "I love you."
"I love you, Father Rawl."
Rawl's eyes slid closed.
"Put your mouth over the horn, my boy, and hold tight."
While Carl did as he was told, Rawl chanted the last charm, his heart pounding. The torches hissed and spit while they burned, the sound intertwining with that of the spell. And then he poured the contents of the crucible into the horn. Carl's eyes snapped wide, and he both inhaled and swallowed involuntarily when the molten lead hit him, searing into his body. Dokken Rawl shuddered with excitement. He let the empty crucible slip from his hands to the ground. The master went on to the next set of incantations, the sending of the boy's spirit to the underworld. He said the words, every word in the proper order, opening the way to the underworld, opening the void, opening the dark emptiness. As his hands extended upward, dark forms swirled around him. Howls filled the night air with the terror of their calls. Dokken Rawl went to the cold stone altar, knelt in front of it, stretched his arm across it, put his face to it. He spoke the words in the ancient language that would link the boy's spirit to him. For a short while, he cast the needed spells. When finished, he stood, fists at his side, his face flushed. Demon Nass stepped forward out of the shadows. Rawl's vision focused on his friend.
"Demon," he whispered, his voice coarse. "Master Rawl," he answered in greeting, bowing his head.
Rawl stepped to Demon, his face drawn and sweat-streaked.
"Take his body from the ground and put it on the altar. Use the bucket of water to wash him clean."
He glanced down at the short sword Demon wore.
"Crack his skull for me, no more, and then you may stand back and wait."
He passed his hands over Demon's head. The air about shuddered.
"This spell will protect you. Wait for me, then, Until I return, just before dawn, I will need you.
He looked away, lost in his thoughts. Demon did as asked, going about the grim task while Rahl continued to chant the strange words, rocking back and forth, his eyes closed as if in a trance. Demon wiped his sword clean on his muscular forearm and returned it to its scabbard. He took one last look at Rahl, who was still lost in the trance.
I hate this part, he muttered to himself.
He turned and went back into the shadows of the trees, leaving the master to his work. Dokken Rahl went to stand behind the altar, breathing in deeply. Suddenly, he cast his hand down at the fire pit, and flames leapt up with a roar. He held out both hands, fingers contorted, and the iron bowl lifted and floated over, setting itself down on the fire. Rahl pulled his curved knife from its sheath and laid it on the boy's wet belly. He slipped his robes from his shoulders and let them drop to the ground, kicking them back out of the way. Sweat covered his lean form, ran down his neck in rivulets. His skin was smooth and taut over his well-proportioned muscles, except on his upper left thigh, across part of his hip and abdomen, and the left side of his erect sex. That was where the scar was, where the flames sent by the old wizard had tasted him, the flames of the wizard's fire that had consumed his father as he stood at his right hand, flames that had licked him also, giving him the pain of the wizard's fire. It had been a fire unlike any other, burning, sticking, searing, alive with purpose, as he had screamed until he lost his voice. Dokken Rahl licked his fingers, and, reaching down, ran them wetly over the bumpy scars. How he had so badly wanted to do that when he had been burned, how he had so badly wanted to do it to stop the terror of the unrelenting pain and burning. But the healers wouldn't let him. They said he mustn't touch the burn, and so they bound him by his wrists to keep him from reaching down. He had licked his fingers and instead rubbed them on his lips as he shook to try to stop his crying, and on his eyes to try to wipe away the vision of having seen his father burned alive. For months he had cried and panted and begged to touch and soothe the burns, but they would not let him. How he hated the wizard! How he wanted to kill him! How he wanted to push his hand into the wizard's living body while he looked into his eyes and pull his heart out! Dokken Rahl took his fingers away from the scar and, picking up the knife, put the thoughts of that time out of his mind. He was a man now. He was the master. He put his mind back to the matter at hand. He wove the proper spell and then plunged the knife into the boy's chest. With care, he removed the heart and put it into the iron bowl of boiling water. Next, he removed the brain and added it to the bowl. Last, he took the testicles and added them too. Then, finally, he put the knife down. Blood mixed with the sweat that covered him. It dripped from his elbows. He laid his arms across the body and offered prayers to the spirits. His face lifted to the dark windows above as he closed his eyes and continued the incantations, rolling them out without having to think. For an hour he went on with the words of the ceremony, smearing the blood on his chest at the proper time. When he had finished with the runes from his father's tomb, he went to the sorcerer's sand where the boy had been buried for the time of his testing. With his arms, he smoothed the sand. It stuck to the blood in a white crust. Squatting, he carefully began drawing the symbols, radiating from the center axis, branching in intricate patterns learned in years of study. He concentrated as he worked into the night, his straight blonde hair hanging down, his brow wrinkled with intensity as he added each element, leaving out no line or stroke or curve, for that would be fatal. At last, finished, he went to the sacred bowl and found the water almost boiled away, as it should be. With magic, he floated the bowl back to the polished stone block and let it cool a little before he took a stone pestle and began grinding. He mashed, sweat running from his face, until he had worked the heart, brain, and testicles into a paste, to which he added magic powders from pockets in his discarded robes. Standing in front of the altar, he held up the bowl with the mixture while he cast the calling spells. He lowered the bowl when finished and looked around at the Garden of Life. He always liked to look upon beautiful things before he went to the underworld. With his fingers, he ate from the bowl. He hated the taste of meat and never ate anything but plants. Now, though, there was no choice. The way was the way. If he wanted to go to the underworld, he had to eat the flesh. He ignored the taste and ate it all, trying to think of it as vegetable paste. Licking his fingers clean, he set the bowl down and went to sit cross-legged on the grass in front of the white sand. His blonde hair was matted in places with dried blood. He placed his hands palm up on his knees, closed his eyes, and took deep breaths, preparing himself for meeting the spirit of the boy. At last, ready, all preparation done, all charms spoken, all spells cast, the master raised his head and opened his eyes. "Come to me, Carl," he whispered in the secret ancient language. There was a moment of dead silence, and then a wailing roar. The ground shook. From the center of the sand, the center of the enchantment, the boy's spirit rose in the form of the Shinga, the underworld beast. The Shinga came, transparent at first, like smoke rising from the ground, turning as if unscrewing itself from the white sand, lured by the drawing. Its head reared as it struggled to pull itself through the drawing, snorting steam from its flared nostrils. Rawl calmly watched as the fearsome beast rose, becoming solid as it came, ripping the ground and pulling the sand up with it, its powerful hind legs pulling through at last as it reared with a wail. A hole opened, black as pitch. Sand around the edges fell away into the bottomless blackness. The Shinga floated above it. Piercing brown eyes looked down at Rawl. "Thank you for coming, Carl." The beast bent forward, nuzzling its muzzle against the master's bare chest. Rawl came to his feet and stroked the Shinga's head as it bucked, calming its impatience to be off. When at last it quieted, Rawl climbed onto its back and held its neck tight. With a flash of light, the Shinga, dark and Rawl astride its back, dissolved back into the black void, corkscrewing itself down as it went. The ground shuddered and the hole closed with a grating sound. The Garden of Life was left in the sudden silence of the night. From the shadows of the trees, Demon Nass stepped forward, forehead beaded with sweat.
"Safe journey, my friend," he whispered. "Safe journey."
Chapter 25. The rain held off for the time being, but the sky remained thickly overcast, as it had been for almost as long as she could remember. Sitting alone on a small bench against the wall of another building, Kaylin smiled to herself as she watched Richard construct the roof of the spirit house. Sweat ran off his bare back, over the swell of his muscles, over the scars where the gar's claws had raked his back. Richard was working with Savidlin and some other men, teaching them. He had told her he didn't need her to translate, that working with one's hands was universal, and if they had to partly figure it out themselves, they would understand it better and have more pride in what they had done. Savidlin kept jabbering questions Richard didn't understand. Richard just smiled and explained things in words the others couldn't understand, using his hands in a sign language he invented as needed. Sometimes the others thought it hilarious and all would end up laughing. They had accomplished a lot for men who didn't understand each other. At first, Richard hadn't told her what he was doing. He just smiled and said she would have to wait and see. First, he took blocks of clay, about 1 by 2 feet, and made wave-like forms. Half the block's face was a concave trough, like a gutter. The other half, a long, rounded hump. He hollowed them out and asked the women who worked the pottery to fire them. Next, he attached 2 uniform strips of wood to a flat board, 1 to each side, and put a lump of soft clay into the center. Using a rolling pin, he flattened the clay, the 2 strips of wood acting as a thickness gauge. Slicing off the excess at the top and bottom of the board, he ended up with slabs of clay of a uniform thickness and size, which he draped and smoothed over the forms the women had fired for him. He used a stick to poke a hole in the 2 upper corners. The women followed him around, inspecting his work closely, so he enlisted their help. Soon he had a whole crew of smiling, chatting women making the slabs and forming them, showing him how to do it better. When the slabs were dry, they could be pulled from the forms. While these were being fired, the women, by then buzzing with curiosity, made more. When they asked how many they should make, he said to just keep making them. Richard left them to their new work and went to the spirit house and began making a fireplace out of the mud bricks that were used for the buildings. Savidlin followed him around, trying to learn everything.
"You're making clay roofing tiles, aren't you?" Kaylin had asked him.
"Yes," he had said with a smile.
"Richard, I have seen thatched roofs that do not leak."
"So have I."
"Then why not simply make their grass roofs over properly so they don't leak?"
"Do you know how to thatch roofs?"
"No."
"Neither do I. But I know how to make tile roofs, so that's what I have to do." While he was building the fireplace and showing Savidlin how to do it, he had other men strip the grass off the roof, leaving a skeleton of poles that ran the length of the building, poles that had been used to tie down each course of grass. Now they would be used to secure the clay tiles. The tiles spanned from one row of poles to the next, the bottom edge laid on the first pole, the top edge laid on the second, with the holes in the tiles used to lash them tight to the poles. The second course of tiles was laid so its bottom edge overlapped the top of the first, covering the holes that tied the tiles down, and owing to their wave-like form, each interlocked with the one before. Because the clay tiles were heavier than the grass, Richard had first reinforced the poles from underneath with supports running up the pitch of the roof with crossmembers bracing them. It seemed as if half the village was engaged in the construction. The birdman came by from time to time to watch the work, pleased with what he saw. Sometimes he sat with Kaylin, saying nothing. Sometimes he talked with her, but mostly he just watched. Occasionally, he slipped in a question about Richard's character. Most of the time while Richard was working, Kaylin was alone. The women weren't interested in her offers of help. The men kept their distance, watching her out of the corners of their eyes, and the young girls were too shy to actually bring themselves to talk to her. Sometimes she found them standing, staring at her. When she would ask their names, they would only give their shy smiles and run away. The little children wanted to approach, but their mothers kept them well clear. She wasn't allowed to help with the cooking or the making of the tiles. Her approaches were politely turned down with the excuse that she was an honored guest. She knew better. She was a confessor. They were afraid of her.